Accession number 31425, Mr. Mike Gagan, Real 4. Now, we're talking about getting towards the end of the war. But one thing I wanted to ask is, what was your what they call morale like? I mean, how nervy would you get with things like bombing V1s, V2s? Personally, I mean, did it scare you? Because you're going from, what, 12 to 15?
Sometimes you got scared. You'd wonder if you've ever come out of the war alive. And why I'm saying this, when I come home from school one day, I walked home with my friend and his sister. She was about 12. And I walked home with them. And next morning in the school, they'd been killed that night. And I just walked home with them. They'd been killed that night. And they lived in First Avenue, Walthamstow. And the whole family had been killed with a bomb. And then you wonder if you're ever going to survive. But at the same time, I think that you've got a hardened to a lot of this. You really, because what you've been through, you've really got hardened. And sometimes you had that couldn't care less attitude, which I did find many times. Myself, you know, I thought, well, that's it. If it's your turn, you know, and I've been injured twice with bombs, so, and had narrow escapes many times. So I think that you get hardened to these things. And at the end of the war, you know, more or less, it'll soon be over. As soon as you heard about D-Day and things like that, and then the air raids stopped a hell of a lot.
Did you follow the progress of the war very closely? I mean,
yes.
How did you do it?
I followed it, and a lot of the times through school as well, and also in the Russian campaign and the Middle East campaign with Rommel and everything in the in Italy, North Africa. And I was also interested in Burma and Singapore. We used to keep... And our heroes then wasn't film stars or anything, or footballers, because you didn't have any. My heroes then were a lot was fighter pilots, and pilots what had really done well. And one man, I used to go out to Abridge when I was 13, 14, 15, go down to Abridge, and there was a fighter drone down there, and also at Hornchurch. And there was one fellow who used to fly out from there, name of Paddy Finucane, and he was a fighter pilot, and I actually met him. We used to go around there and land in, and I used to stand at the gate, you know, and you wouldn't allow to go in or nothing like that, because he, and I was there, and this man come out one day, and they said, you know, this is, I think he was a flying officer then, Paddy Finucane. He later got killed flying a mosquito just after D-Day. But he come there, and I was about 6 foot from him. So I shouted out, "Hello, mister," and he gave me a little wave. And they went, you know. But they used to be my heroes, people like that. And also anyone, especially in Crete and things like that, I've always followed war. Different people, and many times people can say of you, you know, something, and I've had the answer where I'll follow them and remember them.
Now, anything else as the war approaches its end, or other stories that we've missed out one way or another?
No, I think that, you know, as the war, but one thing what...
You're still in the Army Cadets right to the end.
Yeah. And one thing what we did used to do, on Chingford Plains, they used to take all the unexploded bombs there, any unexploded bombs, down by the Connaught Waters on Chingford Plains, they'd take them down there. And it was a big area, a couple of hundred foot square, and there'd be bombs all laying there. And you'd find people walking round saying, "Cool, look at that bomb, look at that one." I mean, you wouldn't think they're doing it these days, but that day, those days, there was barbed wire, and I can see it now, big bombs, and that, you know, because the bomb disposal squad did a marvellous job. And
they didn't detonate them, they just left them on Chingford.
They just left them on, it was all in its enclosure, but there was no
where
one.
Where was it again? Chingford, sorry.
Chingford Plains.
Plains,
yeah. By Connaught Water. And all there'd be is strands of barbed wire all the way round. And people would go up and stand there looking at the bombs. Now, these days, they shut a whole beach because there was a hand grenade found. But those days, I mean, the people are staying there. One thing I remember...
Did you go there?
Oh, many times. And one thing I remember, which happened not far from here, I think I was about 13.
So it's a bit before where we are now. But yeah. Tell us now. Yeah.
Well, an aircraft come down, a fighter aircraft come down, just by the rising sun.
British.
I think it was British, or that, of course we didn't know it, they said it was a plane. And I went there and it had crashed just opposite in the field, opposite the rising sun at Woodford. And we all went up there, but the RAF regiment had some men round there guarding it, and they had taped it all off, put a rope round it, so we wasn't allowed to go too near, because they said there might be some explosives on it. And everything like that, even bullets. And but I always remember that, because I think all the school, after school, I think the whole school went up to see the aircraft what had crashed that morning up there. So
any other stories before we get to VE Day? If you
I can't think of many there. You know, it was just there was so much happening, but I can always remember going to when the bomb fell, the V1 fell in Churchill on the fish queue when I was 14, and rushed round there, and we were helping to get people out, because if any air raid, a lot of boys my age and that, we'd always shoot round to see what we could do. And I went, climbed through one room what had been badly, and I found a body with no head on. And what had happened, there was a woman sitting at a desk typing, and I suppose the air raid warning had gone, and this is where the V1 fell, and she never left it. And the typewriter had blown, come right through her head into a wall. And I was one of the first there to get the body. And it was a bit nerve-wracking, you know, but You took it all in your stride, then, because this is what.
It didn't give you nightmares or anything.
No. You're so used to it, and things like that. And I mean, I've taken another man there. He's got his leg nearly hanging off, and I took my belt off, my trousers, and put as a tourniquet. And then the first aid got grabbed him quick, and did what they had to do and took him away. So I think that all the young people there did their bit in the cadets and everything like that, wherever they could.
Now tell me about VE Day then. Were there any celebrations or street parties? I know the family weren't wealthy, but I mean...
VE Day, yes, there was everywhere, there was street parties going all on in those days.
Did your street have one?
yes, and also we went to one in Grange Road, Walthamstow.
Now, what were these street parties like? Because, again, it's something that doesn't happen, and even when you try it now, it doesn't work. What was it like then?
Well, a lot of places, they might have built something out of old timber and that. You didn't have all the scaffold poles, what you've got these days. You had the big old timber scaffold poles and things like this. You didn't have what they got, the aluminium and that. Of course, most iron was used up during the wartime. Everyone would make a lot of canopy or something, and you'd get all the local talent in, and they might have a big bonfire in the roads, and everyone, you'd all be round it, even having lights on, the end of the war, just having lights on, it was fantastic, you know. And street lighting, they managed to get some street lighting come on, and a lot of the places still had gas lighting, and they'd get up and you'd see a bloke turn it up and he'd light the gas and things like that. And
so what would you do? I mean, was there food and drink? Or
no,
At the past, I mean.
No, what you've got to realise, if it was only made for the street, the street would give the kids in the street or the people what they're getting of food, you know what I mean? It would be for them, not for any gate crashes or nothing like that. But if you went to the road and there's someone there, then you're always sure of something to eat or drink and that. And it was really good. And then I went up to London, all up in Leicester Square and outside Buckingham Palace and things like that.
And what was it like then? It was, you know...
Oh, it was... You find all ex-servicemen, all from different countries, Australians, Americans, New Zealand, everyone all joining in the fun. It was really, really great, you know, and all the... And ex-servicemen, like, you know, they couldn't go wrong. All the girls kissing the sailors, and it was... Everyone was happy, you know what I mean? You didn't hear no bad words or nothing. And when the Queen come and the King come out, and the old King and Queen come on the balcony, I can always remember we were there, and the greatest cheer went up, because the King and the Queen, the old Queen Mum, they used to come down the East End of London during the war. I've met them a few times, and give a bit of morale booster, you know. And them not leaving the country, which they could have done and gone to Canada or somewhere away from the bombing, they stayed in London. And that really give the people hope and everything like this. And I can always remember them coming round and the King shaking hands with people.
So he was very popular in the East End, the
King. He was very popular. And the old Queen Mum. And the old Queen Mum used to love jelly deals, and you'd get someone and give her a packet of jelly deals from Billy's Gate if she went round that way. So it was great, you know.
What happened after the war finished? I mean, there's VJ Day. Was there another set of celebration on VJ Day? Or
yeah, not? There was a lot of celebrations on VJ Day.
What do you remember of them?
Especially, well, a lot of people have been released before then, you know, have been prisoners of war, and a lot of came home, and they showed you the state what some of them prisoners was in. And, of course, when VJ, that was the end of all hostilities, and there was big celebrations all over, but not so much as there was in the VE Day, because that was actually on our doorstep, you know. But then you got fellas coming home, like from Burma and everything like that, the Chindits, and wherever they was coming home, you'd, even if there's one person in that street, you find all bunting and everything in the street, you know, welcome home and everything like that. It was lovely.
So what happened after the war finished for you then? You're still working on, I mean, there's still plenty of damage.
I still kept in the building. I still kept in the building and everything. Because it wasn't only during the war, it was after the war when you got more work shoveling, and because then they decided to pull this building down or that building, you know, in the streets. And we had to go around still shoveling and everything like this to keep everything going, you know. So... it was for many years after the war.
Now,
it was a hell of a lot of work.
So you carried on working for the same firms, you know, demolition and repair. So what happens next then? When you must be start, you know, you start to, did you leave the army cadets? When did you leave them?
Oh, I left them just after the war, because
in 45
because they more or less packed up in the church hall what we was in. The church wanted they were taking over again, you know what I mean, the church. And the Home Guards was more or less disbanded. And it just more or less faded away. You know, same as the Air Cadets. The Air Cadets carried on for, and the Army, they carried on for years after, but it wasn't the same as what it was during the war, you
know. So you left them?
Yeah.
Now, so what happens next then in this story?
As I say, I left, and you look for different activities in other things, you know. So, it's just life. You took life as it came then, you know. And you'd go to more dances of a night, you know, because a lot of dance halls are opening up and different places where you could go and have a good bit of fun and things like that. So, and also boats were coming back on the ponds and everything, and you might get one pub, give the other one a challenge, and you find two lots of pubs, you find about 300 people all around the Olive Ponds, and all on the boats, rocking the boat, you know, and cheering them on. It used to be a real bit of fun them days, you know.
Now, you're starting to approach, 46, 47, you're starting to approach when you're going to be called up. So what are you deciding to do about that?
Well, I'm still working on the building, and I didn't wait to get called up. I put my age up.
And tell me about that. What made you decide to do that?
Well, a lot of my mates had gone away in the army. They'd been called up and things like this. And I was getting a bit browned off with the building and things like this. And then
you've been doing it 2 or 3 or 4 years then, Bart.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the firm I worked for, they packed up and I went to work with another firm. And then I worked with a chap who'd been a prisoner of war, but we was just doing decorating and repairs in houses and everything like this, you know, what the government's, you know, give it out the contracts, and the government was paying, like, it might be a house all badly damaged and that, you've got to go in plastering and decorating it right through. Well, I was only working with one or two people then, and I was getting bored. So the end of 1946, I put my age up, and I volunteered for the army.
Now, how'd you go about doing that? Where'd you go?
Well, I went and put my age up, and then I had to go to Whips Cross Territorial Centre, and I had to go there, have a medical, everything like that.
And then when was this in 46, December?
Well, I joined the army in November 46. No, I'd done all the administration, and then I was going to go in under Christmas, but then I put it back till the 13th of January 1947.
Now, so, what about your medical? Do you remember anything about that?
Yes, I passed all my medical, everything like that. The only thing was I had a small cast in the left eye. And they don't know whether that was caused through a bomb or boxing or anything. It could have been anything, you know what I mean? And I just had a small cast in that eye. It was like a fold.
But no problem with it?
No problem. And they gave me the King's Shilling.
And who were you joining? I mean, were you joining the Royal Artillery? Or were you
No. Then it was the General Service Corps.
So it's just the Army?
Yeah, it was the army, and you had to go and do all your basic training with the. And I went with the Essex Regiment.
Now, where were you told? Where were you told to report to in January 47? Then
Worley Barracks, Brentwood. I went to Worley.
Is that where you did your basic training?
Yeah.
And was that under the auspices of the Essex Regiment?
Yeah.
Was it their depot then?
Oh yes, their own chapel and everything.
Now Worley, is that spelt W-O-R or
no,
W-A-R?
No, W-A-R-L-E-Y.
Now, when you went, what would you know, you turn up in January. Now, you've had a lot of army cadet experience, but what was your reception like? Because you turn up, you're still a civilian.
Well, I turned up on the 13th, but the main intake never came till the 15th, 2 days later. And I always remember it because the first sergeant I ever had was Sergeant Deed, and one lot had left a week before, and I had to clean out the four barrack rooms because I was the only one arrived before them, so I had a job of cleaning out the four barrack rooms.
On your own?
Yeah, and cleaning all the lockers, which was very good because I found enough Blanco to last me all my training. I found a watch and some money in one as well. In those days, we was getting £1 a week, but you had to allow home 7 or 6 a week. And so the little bit of money come in handy, and a Blanco. And I cleaned everything up, but I enjoyed it. It was different life, you know. The first time I'd ever been left home for that sort of period.
Had you been kitted out there?
No. I was still. They gave me denims, just ordinary denims, to clean everything but not officially kitted out. That was just to save wearing your civvies, you know. I was wearing civvies like for a couple of days. And then when the main lot come in, they were designated to each room, what to go in and everything like that. And then we had our own lockers each.
Now, can you describe your barrack room? The whole thing?
The barrack room.
Was it a hut or was it a proper barracks?
No, it was a proper barracks. And you had, in one opening, you had, as you went in the door, you had a barrack room to the left and a barrack room to the right. Then you went up a flight of stairs. Oh, in between the two barrack rooms was the toilets and the ablutions. And and in the upstairs was the same up there. You got the toilets there and a barrack room on each side. And you'd have the NCO sleep in the little, in the room on the corner so that he could keep eye on everything.
What was
like
the
that.
Actual room like then? How
the actual
laid
room,
out?
We had about, I think there was about a dozen beds to a room. You had a good bit of space either side, a few feet either side of your bed, and you had a locker. It was a metal bed. There was a fireplace in the end of the room and some coal in the side, which you wasn't allowed to use because the coal bin had been blackened and whitened round the top, so you didn't have a fire on. And you had lockers above your bed, but everything was spotlessly clean. You had to have it spotless, and you polished the floor, everything. So, and you had the discipline, and no clothes thrown anywhere. Everything had to be hung up.
Well, let's look at a typical day. So, you know, how the training... Well, first, what about your uniform? You've had a uniform in the Army Cadets. What did they give you, though, in the proper Army?
In the Army, they gave you a uniform, roughly the size what you wanted. They'd just measure you up, give you the size there. They give you shirts, whatever colour you took, a couple of shirts, underpants, boots, slippers, shorts, a greatcoat, a hat, and you wasn't allowed to wear a side forage cap. You had to have a beret. And they'd give you that and other things like that. But all your washing gear and everything, you had to buy yourself. You had to buy that yourself. And also polish sticks, that was what you put your buttons on and you polish. And you had to buy all that yourself, but you could buy it cheap sometimes in the shop in the barracks.
The canteen shop,
yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, what about, did your uniform fit, or just where it touched?
It fitted where it touched, but they took you to a tailor, and he'd measure you up, and he'd put down what you got to have and everything like that. And, you know, I mean, on the whole, considering, it did make some people look smart, you know what I mean?
Now, what about haircut? I mean, how short was your hair when you went in? And what about
I had a Boston haircut before I went in.
What's a Boston haircut?
The Boston, it was to be cut round the back, come all the way over, and it would be cut down there, so that it hangs over the back of your head, you know, and it would be sticking out. That used to be the thing those days. So they took us into the barbers, and my whole room, there was a dozen of us, and one barber did all our hair within the hour. He cut a dozen hair within the hour.
Now, what cut did he give you?
He started at the bottom with me, started at the back of my neck, and he went all over my head. So I had a big line where everything was off. Then the next one, that was all off. And I always remember I got they cut all our hairs and we had no hair on. I just had a little tuft in the front.
And how long was it on the rest, on the actual head? Nothing? Or skin head?
Not shaved, but it cut all your hair right off.
So just a quarter of an inch or half an inch?
Yeah. And what actually happened, we had all that and we went into the barber, and he's gone, you know, one fella there, he had long hair down on his shoulder. And he was a bit of a, one of these, in them days he didn't have them like a hippie type, but he was in that style. And he come out and he looked a different man. I said, your mother won't recognise you. They've got no hair on. He had no hair and it's come all the way over and everything like that. And it was, and the RSM come round like, you know, looking, oh, you've been in, you know. And he had his head shaved, the RSM. You know, don't let it get long, will you? You know, well, the sergeant made that, like, and he's... And it was, and of course, it was a joke then, you know, a lot of the fellas, you know, because when you're looking on the floor, and my hair was jet black then, and when I'm looking, I've got all the hair on the floor, and big pile in the corner, because them days you didn't just shovel it up, put it in, and you'd be lucky in the evening if someone come round with a sack, because you didn't have plastic bags or nothing them days, you know, and different things like that. And
did you mind that your hair had gone?
Well, you got so used to it, a lot of people really objected, you know. And I was only in there about 2 weeks and someone beat the barber up. So I suppose someone had got the ump, not because they've cut his hair off, you know. But the third day in the army, I had all my hair cut and I had a bit in the front. And I got in a bit of trouble. What happened, because it was the worst winter in January 47, worst winter in the century. And I was warming some water up in some mess tins. And we had the fire alight on the corner there. They'd give us permission to light the fire.
And in your room?
In the room. And I had my mess tin warming some water up to have a shave. And an old soldier come in, been in the army about 6 weeks. So he said, I'm having that water. So I said, oh yeah. I said, no one gets that water, it's mine. He said, well, if I can't have it, you won't have it. And he kicked it all over the fire. And I hit him. And of course, in the end, the fellas had to pull me off. And I was going mad. The sergeant come in, everyone like that. And I had to... They put me in the guard room 3 days after I'm in the army. And the next morning, I'm in front of the officer. Because the fellow had to have medical treatment, you know. And I had to go in front of the officer and he asked me why. Well, in the meantime, they put me in the guard room and I had a little bit of air. And the RSM happened to walk in and someone said he's put in for fighting. The RSM take him, get him haircut. He gave me another haircut and I ain't got no hair. And he said, take him and get him another haircut, you know. So it took me to give me another haircut and I ain't got nothing then. And
they took the little tuft off.
Yeah. And I went in front of the officer and I told it, you know, and he says to me, what happened? And I had three witnesses there. And I said, he'd become the old soldier. So I said, and that's it. I said, he kicked all my water over. I said, and we just got the fire going. I said, he's put the fire out. I said, there was dust everywhere off the fire. I said, I just lost it. He said, and he's looking, and he says to the other chap, like, he's got a black eye and all his jaw out. So he said, is that what happened? He said, well, he said, did it happen? Because he's heard the witnesses. Yes, sir. He said, well, you deserved all you got. And he said to me, but for you going in the guard room, everything, he said, you're going to get three extra guards. So I got three extra guards, and one of the guards was guarding the sergeant's mess the following night. And while I'm there, they called me in, give me a nice meal and everything, because my sergeant, he understood what it was all about, and I couldn't go wrong, you know.
So it was the very least of punishments.
Yeah, and you know, it was nothing, but it was, and it taught that soldier, who was an old soldier, been in about 6 weeks before me. He thought he was it, but he wasn't.